This is Radio Hangar, and I'm Tail Dragger. Pull up a chair, because today I want to tell you about a pilot who did something that should have made her the most famous aviator on Earth, and somehow the world just moved on. Her name was Beryl Markham, September 4, 1936. She climbed into a Percival Vega Gull at Abingdon, England, pointed the nose west, and flew solo across the Atlantic Ocean. Not east to west the easy way with the prevailing winds at your back. West, into the headwinds. Into the weather, into the dark. She did it alone, in a single-engine airplane, and she did it before most men had the nerve to try. But before we dig into that flight, today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, to understand Beryl Markham, you have to understand where she came from, because nothing about her life was ordinary. She was born in 1902, Ashwell, England, but her father, Charles Clutterbuck, was a horse trainer. And when Beryl was just 4 years old, he packed up the family and moved to British East Africa, what we now call Kenya. Her mother didn't last, she went back to England, but little Beryl stayed with her father on a farm in the highlands outside Nairobi. So picture this, a barefoot English girl growing up on the edge of the Great Rift Valley. She hunted warthog with the local Nandi children. She learned to track game before she learned to read properly. She was mauled by a neighbor's lion when she was maybe 7 or 8 years old and lived to tell the story. This was not a woman who was going to be afraid of a little Atlantic weather. By 18, she was training racehorses on her own, and she was good at it. One of the youngest licensed trainers in all of Kenya, she won the Kenya St. Leger with a horse she'd trained herself. She could have lived the rest of her life in the horse world and been remembered for that alone. But then Tom Campbell Black showed up. Campbell Black was a bush pilot, one of those East African aviators who flew mail and passengers across landscapes that had no roads, no charts, and certainly no control towers. He taught Beryl to fly, and she took to it like she'd been born for it. By 1931, she had her commercial license. Think about that for a second, 1931. There were barely any women flying commercially anywhere on Earth. And here's Beryl Markham hauling mail, supplies, and passengers across the Kenyan bush in a little Avroavian. She scouted elephant herds from the air for wealthy safari hunters. She flew medical supplies to remote settlements. When her engine quit, she put the airplane down wherever she could find a flat spot between the termite mounds and the thorn trees. The African bush taught her things about flying that you cannot learn at any flight school. She flew without radio, without weather reports. She navigated by rivers and ridgelines and the angle of afternoon shadows on the savannah. She learned to read the sky the way her Nandi friends had taught her to read animal tracks on the ground, and that education was about to matter more than anyone could imagine. Now here's where it gets interesting. By the mid-1930s, the Atlantic Ocean was the great prize. Lindbergh had crossed it eastbound solo in 27. Amelia Earhart had crossed it solo eastbound in 32. But westbound solo was a different animal entirely. The prevailing winds blow east across the North Atlantic, which means an eastbound crossing gets a tailwind. Westbound, you're fighting the wind the entire way. The headwinds add hours to the flight, hours you might not have fuel for. The weather systems come at you head-on. It is longer, harder, and far more dangerous. Jim Mollison had done it westbound in 32, but barely. He crash-landed in a bog in New Brunswick. The westbound crossing had a nasty reputation, and with good reason, Beryl decided she wanted it. She went to England in 1936 and found herself a Percival Vega Gull. Now, the Vega Gull was a lovely little low-wing monoplane, a gentleman's touring airplane, really. Wooden construction, fabric covered, a single de Havilland Gypsy 6 engine turning out about 200 horsepower. Not exactly a transatlantic powerhouse. They modified it with extra fuel tanks until the airplane carried more gasoline than it had any right to, something like 255 gallons stuffed into every available space. The airplane was called the Messenger. On the evening of September 4th, she climbed in. The weather briefing was not encouraging. There were headwinds forecast at every altitude, fog banks over the ocean, icing conditions probable over Newfoundland and Nova Scotia, a front pushing through the Western Atlantic that nobody could precisely locate. She took off anyway. The first hours were straightforward enough, if you can call flying alone over the open Atlantic at night in a single-engine airplane straightforward. She climbed to about 2,000 feet and settled in. The Gypsy 6 drummed away behind the firewall. The exhaust stubs glowed dull orange in the darkness. There was nothing to see below but black water and nothing ahead but more of the same. She flew by dead reckoning and by the stars when she could see them. No autopilot, no GPS, no moving map, just a compass, an airspeed indicator, and the kind of spatial awareness that comes from years of flying over trackless African bush. The weather caught her somewhere over the mid-Atlantic cloud, rain, turbulence, that shook the little Vega gull like a terrier shaking a rat. Ice began forming on the wings. Now in 1936, there was no dacing equipment on an airplane like this. When ice builds on a wing, it destroys the airfoil, lift drops, drag increases. The airplane gets heavier and heavier. At some point, it simply will not fly anymore. She climbed to try to get above it. She descended to try to get below it. She flew through it because there was nowhere else to go. The ice came and went, and came again through the long hours of darkness. Then the fuel gauge started doing things she did not like. Somewhere over Nova Scotia, after roughly 21 hours in the air, the Gypsy 6 coughed. Fuel starvation. She was close. She could see land below her. Cape Breton Island, Nova Scotia, but close is not the same as there when your engine is dying. The engine quit. She put the Vega Gull down in a peat bog on Cape Breton Island, near a place called Baleen Cove. The airplane nosed over in the soft ground. Beryl hit her head on the instrument panel. She was bleeding, dazed, but alive. She had not made New York, which had been her intended destination. But she had crossed the Atlantic Ocean, solo, westbound, the first woman ever to do it, and only the second or third pilot of any gender to survive a solo westbound crossing. The local fisherman who found her thought she was a man at first. She was wearing flying overalls and a leather helmet, and she was covered in oil and blood. When they realized she was a woman, and when they found out what she had just done, they could not quite believe it. For a few days, Beryl Markham was front page news. There were photographs and interviews and congratulations. The mayor of New York invited her to the city. She went, and she was celebrated. But then the news cycle moved on the way news cycles do, and somehow the world forgot. Part of it was timing. 1936 was a crowded year. The Spanish Civil War had just started. Edward VIII was about to abdicate the British throne. There was plenty competing for the front page. Part of it was that she had not reached New York. Landing in a Canadian bog, however heroic, did not have the same ring as touching down at Roosevelt Field, and part of it, frankly, was that the world did not quite know what to do with Beryl Markham. She did not fit the mold. She was not demure. She was not modest. She was tall, striking, and utterly uninterested in playing the part of the grateful little woman who got lucky. She had done this thing because she was a great pilot, and she knew it, and she did not pretend otherwise. After the flight, she moved to California for a while. She wrote a book. Or rather, there has been a decades-long argument about how much of the book she wrote herself. But the book exists, and it is magnificent. It is called West with the Night, published in 1942. Ernest Hemingway himself read it and wrote to his editor Maxwell Perkins saying, and I'm paraphrasing, that she had written so well that he felt ashamed of himself as a writer. Hemingway, ashamed because of Beryl Markham's prose. The book sank into obscurity for 40 years, then in 1983 it was rediscovered and republished, and suddenly people remembered, oh right, this woman flew the Atlantic the hard way in a wooden airplane and then wrote one of the great memoirs of the 20th century. She had gone back to Kenya by then, back to training racehorses, back to the highlands and the red dirt and the smell of eucalyptus and horse sweat that had been her real home since she was 4 years old. She won the Kenya Derby six times. Six times. She was a champion in two completely separate lives. She died in Nairobi in 1986, at the age of 83. What gets me about Beryl Markham is the completeness of the thing. She was not a one-dimensional record chaser. She was a bush pilot, a horse trainer, a writer, and an adventurer who happened to also be one of the most skilled aviators of her generation. And the skill is what matters here. That crossing was not a stunt, it was a demonstration of airmanship at the highest level. Dead reckoning across an ocean, weather that would ground most modern instrument-rated pilots, ice on the wings with no way to remove it, an engine that quit short of the destination, and she still got the airplane on the ground in one piece and walked away. There is a passage in West with the Night where she writes about flying over Africa at night, and she describes the loneliness of it, the way the engine's sound becomes your only companion, the way the stars above and the scattered fires below are the only proof that the world still exists. And you read that and you think, yes, that is exactly what it is like. She knew. She is in that small company of pilots who were also genuine literary artists. Saint-Exupéry, of course, Ernest Gann, and Beryl Markham, who belonged right there with them but spent decades in undeserved obscurity. Most of what I've drawn on today comes from Mary Lovell's biography, straight on till morning and from Markham's own west with the night, which you should read if you have not. If you want to dig deeper, radiohanger.com is the place. I'm Taildragger, and I'll see you next time we open up the hangar.